From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette, and this is Idaho Matters. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. We will get you up to date on all of the news that made headlines this last week. And today, our panel includes Nicole Blanchard. She is the Idaho Statesman Outdoors reporter, our very own James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, Ian Max Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Nate Sunderland, managing editor of East Idaho News. Hi, everybody, and happy Friday.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
So let's start with what will be marking the one-year anniversary of the overturning of Roe v. Wade. That actually will be tomorrow, June 24th. Jimmy, I know you've been taking a deep dive into this. So where does Idaho stand 1 year later?
Pretty much where we stood in August when the near total abortion ban took effect, meaning that abortions are really only allowed in cases of rape, incest, or when the life of the mother is threatened, which is a pretty contentious point. You know, doctors are wondering, or at least have testified to the legislature saying, you know, at what point is a life threatened? I mean, how are you going to judge this in a courtroom when we could face 2 to 5 years in prison for violating this law? So that's kind of what legislators and, pro and anti-abortion rights groups have been negotiating over the past year, leading to the culmination of one bill that would have seemingly added a few more exceptions in that realm. But that was torpedoed back in March. And what they came up with instead was this sort of compromise where the initial law said that, you know, doctors could defend themselves in court by saying they thought the life of the mother was threatened when they performed an abortion. Now it's just an exception, and they theoretically should not be charged for that, saying that negotiations will continue throughout this year into next legislative session. But as pointed out by several Democrats, they're not too, they're a little skeptical that anything can be done in an election year.
So, Jimmy, what about hospitals and doctors? Because we've definitely, I think, seen some domino effects.
We have. You had this survey of, I think, more than 100 OBGYNs in the state, if I'm remembering correctly. And about half of them said that they were considering leaving the state due to the abortion ban, which is something that we hear anecdotally during these testimony exchanges between them and lawmakers, but interesting to get, you know, a little bit broader scope on that. But then, of course, we've seen Valor Health in Emmett and Bonner General Hospital up in North Idaho saying that we're shutting down their obstetrics units, saying that, part of this is due to the political and legal climate. Other factors include, either changing demographics, older people moving in who aren't having babies, or, you know, women who choose to have their babies at home, maybe with a doula or a midwife to help in those circumstances instead of going to the hospital. But regardless, there's fewer or less access to these obstetrics, doctors than we've seen in the past, for sure.
So, Jimmy, have any of, medical professionals said anything about, their concerns as we, go into the second year of the overturning of Roe versus Wade?
Oh, of course. I mean, you have doctors suing to overturn the law in federal court right now. An attempt to do so in state court failed last year, which allowed, the trigger ban to take effect. But they basically say that, they fully expect women with not so rare conditions in pregnancy to potentially lead to either, loss of fertility if the mother does survive, or, killing the mother and possibly the fetus or child itself. That's the main thing that they're concerned about, and the fact that they could serve a prison sentence of up to 2 to 5 years for trying to do what they think is best for the patient is something else they're considering as well.
And Jimmy, correct me if I'm wrong, but since the overturning of Roe versus Wade, Planned Parenthood in Ontario, Oregon opened a clinic, correct? Or was that clinic already open?
No, they opened a clinic in Ontario, which currently provides medication abortions. And I spoke with one of their communications people earlier this week who says that in August they will begin allowing or offering surgical abortions. So right now, up until August, the closest clinics that I know of that offer those sorts of services for surgical abortions are in Bend, Oregon, or the Tri-Cities in Washington.
Okay. Appreciate the update on that, Jimmy. Clark, this weekend, the Idaho GOP will gather for its State Central Committee meeting. And you're reporting that some high-profile Republicans are speaking out against some of these proposals that are expected to be voted on. So what's going on here?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the meeting, I think, is just underway right now out in Challis at a Christian retreat called the Living Waters Ranch. A group of five different Idaho legislators, all Republicans, that's Senator Ben Adams and Representatives Kevin Andrus, Dustin Manwaring, Jeff Ellers, and James Petsky signed a joint letter opposing two of these different rules that are going to be voted on by Republican Party leaders this weekend. And what they're saying is that it's going to make it hard for new voters and younger people to participate in the Republican Party and to participate in Idaho primary elections. And the first rule that they really focused on is a rule that could make it so that people who switch their party affiliation from another political party to the Republican Party have to wait more than 2 years to vote in a Republican primary. Wow. It's kind of a little confusing how this rule is worded, but basically what it says is in order to vote in the Republican primary election, you have to be registered and affiliated with the Idaho Republican Party by December 30th each year. But if you had been affiliated with a different political party at any point in the prior 12 months, you have to wait another 12 months to affiliate, and then you can vote in the next year's Republican primary. And so these legislators came out and said, this is really going to hurt the efforts that we have going on to convince first-time young voters to switch their party affiliation to the Republican Party. They said they're doing work on college campuses and in churches, and that a proposal like this, if it's adopted and passed by the Idaho Republican Party, would be kind of like shooting themselves in the foot and undoing these efforts that they have going on to try and persuade young people to switch their political affiliation to the Republican Party. And so they're saying, you're not thinking about the big picture here. The risk is fracturing our party. And that's one of the big rules that they're focused on. Another would make it so that certain groups like the Young Republicans and the College Republicans and the Federation of Republican Women would no longer be on the executive committee that gets to vote on these rules. And so again, they're saying, these are people that are interested in helping our party, that have been a part of our party, and you're alienating them, and you're not going to be let them part of the process. And so it's always interesting when the Republicans get together for their summer meetings or for their conventions, and they vote on their rules and bylaws, because we get to see the division and the divide and the different directions that people want to go in the party. But there's a number of different rules that are going to be voted on this weekend, including rules about creating a new presidential caucus if the state does not basically call a special legislative session to reinstate the presidential primary that legislators kind of unintentionally eliminated last year. So there's a lot going on, and there's a lot that we'll be looking to follow up on after this Republican summer meeting this weekend.
Okay. And as you said, live at noon right now, this meeting has started. So if you're listening at 8 tonight, some of this may have already been decided. Correct, Clark?
Yeah. And it continues Saturday. I'm not there. I'm not going to be reporting from the meeting itself. But yeah, it started today on Friday, and it will continue into Saturday. And we'll try to follow up, I know, early next week and let people know about the outcome of some of these votes and some of these proposed rules and resolutions.
Okay. So Nate, let's head on over to East Idaho with you. A Chubbuck woman has pleaded guilty to poisoning her husband. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this case actually got a little bit contentious in Eastern Idaho. About 2 weeks ago, we had a family come into our newsroom with what sounded like almost these outrageous claims that that this husband came in and said my ex-wife poisoned me and a whole bunch of my family with cattle vaccines over a period of 6 months. We don't know why she did it, but the police wouldn't look at it. And the prosecutor wouldn't look at it until we went and did our own personal investigation.
Wow.
And so it was the family that had to go out and they had to find an out-of-state lab to get all their blood tested and all the work. And they eventually took that to police. And the police said, well, you know, we're still not going to do anything. This isn't quite enough evidence until the family was able to, through some phone calls with this ex-wife, convince her to confess to essentially poisoning them. And then they took that to the prosecutor and some charges were filed. What kind of made this a bigger issue in Eastern Idaho, and one that actually filled the courtroom earlier this week, was that initially charges were felony. They were mm-hmm. felony aggravated battery, felony poisoning. But the prosecutor opted to drop those charges, and we didn't know why initially, to just two misdemeanors. And so there were several protests held outside the courtroom earlier this week by family and friends with signs, and they had to move the proceedings to a new set of courtrooms because they had so many people out there protesting this woman who was not being charged with felonies. She was being charged with misdemeanors, and she had taken a plea agreement with the Bannock County Prosecutor's Office. In the end, we were able to find out that the reason the prosecutor decided to drop down some of these charges was because there were some problems with the credibility of the lead detective mm-hmm. on the case. And problems with one of the witnesses as well. In the mm-hmm. end, she took an Alford plea, which means that she admits there's enough evidence for the court to find that she's guilty, but she doesn't mm-hmm. admit to actually having done the poisoning.
Hmm. You know what I find so fascinating about this, Nate, is that you know, this might sound crazy to some people, but over the years, you do get phone calls and you get people coming into newsrooms, you know, telling you these tales. And normally, I think, you know, in most times, it's exaggerated. So the fact that you know, your station followed up on this and this is how the prosecution got involved, I mean, really says something, I think, about listening to those folks, even when it may seem like this is so too far-fetched.
Absolutely. We were very skeptical, very surprised in the beginning of this, and to see it actually all, well, to see a conviction in the end, I mean, it was pretty crazy.
Yeah. So Nicole, get us updated on some conservation groups that are apparently suing the Forest Service. And this has to do with backcountry airstrips.
Yeah, Gemma. So four conservation groups. We've got Wilderness Watch, Great Old Broads for Wilderness, and then Friends of the Clearwater and Friends of the Bitterroot, all signed on together to sue some Forest Service officials, including the director of the Payette National Forest. They're saying that the Forest Service has essentially allowed hobby pilots to use a collection of four backcountry airstrips in the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness, that are not supposed to be used for anything other than an emergency, really. And so the allegation is that the Forest Service has violated the Wilderness Act and Idaho's Central Idaho Wilderness Act by planning to maintain these airstrips and by declining to cite pilots that are landing on those four airstrips in non-emergency situations.
Okay, so where is the lawsuit? Where does it stand right now?
It's brand new, so it was filed at the beginning of this week. So it is going to take some time to kind of see how this shakes out. But it is an issue that's been going on for some time. So the airstrips, these four that are in question, they're called the Big Creek Four. There are several other airstrips in the Frank Church that actually are allowed to be used because they were considered grandfathered in when the wilderness was created in 1980. So the other four have been kind of controversial for a little bit because technically they existed in 1980, but they weren't being used regularly. So over the years, we've seen a couple different pushes to allow these airstrips to be used and a couple different decisions by the Forest Service to decommission them and then to more recently start to do some maintenance on them, which is what has prompted this lawsuit.
So, Ian, let me go to you really quick. We've had some shakeup in the Boise City Council recently, and now we have another council member saying he's stepping down. So tell us what's going on here.
Yeah, so Patrick Bajan, a city council member who lives in the North End, and who was elected to his first term a few years ago, announced this week that he's not going to be running for a second term this fall. And that's significant, you know, in part because there's, as you said, there's been a shakeup in recent weeks on the council. Council President Holly Woodings also announced that she's not running. In addition to those two, Elaine Clegg, of course, the longtime city council member, left the council a couple months ago to run Valley Regional Transit. So that's part of why this, I think, news is significant. But it's also significant for the upcoming council races this fall, because as listeners may know, the city council is transitioning to a fully geographic district-based system. So there will no longer be council members elected at large. And had Councilmember Bajan decided to run, he would have faced another incumbent, Jimmy Halliburton, who has announced that he's running, and they would have had to run against each other because they live in the same district. So Bajan's announcement means that that sort of competition between two incumbents will no longer occur.
Okay, so a lot of changes we're going to be seeing, I think, within this city council as we move forward. So, Clark, back in May, the University of Idaho announced it would be acquiring the for-profit University of Phoenix, and around $500 and some million. This announcement, it took the public by surprise. It took some legislators by surprise. So there was like a big meeting that happened, what, last Friday? Tell us about this and what happened, because University of Idaho basically got grilled by some legislators.
Yeah, that's a pretty good summary. And yeah, we're talking about a meeting last Friday at the Idaho State Capitol building. This is the Idaho Legislature's Joint Finance Appropriations Committee. It's JFAC, that's the big budget committee. And they basically got together with University of Idaho President Scott Green, a few other university officials, some lawyers, and said, you know, basically what you said, that this deal caught us completely by surprise. It was approved by the State Board of Education just over a month ago, back on May 18th, and it had really only come to light publicly 24 hours beforehand. And legislators said, okay, we didn't hear anything about this during the recent legislative session. This never came up at your budget hearing. We have no idea what's going on here. Tell us a little bit about this deal. And so for 2 hours, they were asking President Green about the deal, and they were looking for reassurances and guarantees, essentially, that that this had been vetted and that this wasn't going to put state taxpayers at risk. And one of the things that I think was frustrating for legislators that kept coming up is that Scott Green from the University of Idaho said that there are some non-disclosure agreements that have been signed between the seller, University of Phoenix, and between the buyer, that are preventing university officials from really discussing some of the details and answering some of the very specific questions that legislators had. Those non-disclosure agreements are still in effect. The sale has not been finalized. There's still a few more steps, including accreditation, and then the bonding that would need to take place before a sale could be finalized. But they said that these non-disclosure agreements remain in place and likely will remain in place for some time, if not always. And so legislators didn't get all of the answers that they were hoping for. President Green did share a couple of pages worth of financial projections, talked a little bit about the management structure, kind of elaborated on the plans to have a new nonprofit organization acquire and then operate the University of Phoenix going forward. So the University of Idaho will not directly own the University of Phoenix. Instead, this new nonprofit that the university will create will own it. And then the idea is that the University of Idaho is doing this because they're concerned. They say they have concerns about an enrollment cliff where they're going to see enrollment drop off among their traditional students who attend classes in person on the Moscow campus. And so the reason they're doing this is because they want the online infrastructure that University of Phoenix has. And so that's why they're doing it, but still a lot of questions about the deal and how it would work. There's a legal analysis that's been performed, but a lot of these documents are covered by this non-disclosure agreement. But yeah, like you said, we do know that the purchase price is going to be $550 million. This new nonprofit is going to have to go out to bond, and they're going to spend, I think, over $650 million with the bonding to acquire this, and that they're hoping that the University of Phoenix will generate at least $10 million a year to send back to the University of Idaho. But still a lot of questions about this deal that, like you said, caught everybody off by surprise. Yeah. It caught me by surprise. I talked to the co-chair of JFAC, Senator Groh. He said he only found out about it the day before. So from a lot of people's perspectives, this hasn't been the most transparent public process. And in fact, the Idaho Press reported yesterday that Attorney General Raul Labrador's office has filed a lawsuit over the executive sessions and this meeting. So there's definitely a lot still that has yet to come out, but the deal is not finalized yet, but they're moving forward.
Okay, so if I understand this correctly, Clark, I mean, this $550 million purchase price, they're going to try to raise that money through bonds, or where do they get this amount of money to be able to go buy this other university?
Yeah. It would be bonding, which is going in, it's borrowing money and going into long-term debt that would be repaid over years. And I think it was Representative Wendy Horman said, you know, we have a few questions here. This is essentially the University of Idaho making plans to acquire an entire multi-state university system, which is what the University of Phoenix is. I think they have an enrollment of something like 84,000 students, but that's down from where it had been. Idaho Education News reported that University of Phoenix's enrollment peaked at nearly 500,000 online students. There have also been lawsuits and settlements where the University of Phoenix paid out, I think, $90 million or more to settle complaints about misleading advertising for their programs and ability to get degrees. That people have questioned University of Phoenix's low graduation rate. Legislators were wondering about its public reputation and its ability to hold its value and to pay off for this essentially to be a good deal. We do know, and other news organizations have reported, that I believe it was the University of Arkansas was in consideration to buy the University of Phoenix recently and then backed out of the deal or opted not to go forward. So understandably, there's a lot of questions, and this meeting last Friday at the state capitol was really one of the first chances that I've seen where legislators in particular got to ask questions and really express their interest in and wanting a more public process and wanting some more information and documents to be revealed. But there's still a lot we don't know. And like I've said, they're moving forward with this nonprofit, but both organizations, accrediting institutions, have to sign off. And then the nonprofit would have to be able to go out to bond and go into long-term debt in order to acquire the University of Phoenix. And that process could continue into 2024, is what we were told at that meeting last week.
Okay.
Ian, there's been an ongoing battle to try and stop a homeless shelter from being built on West State Street in Boise. Can you first give us a brief synopsis of this issue and then update us on what a judge has decided?
Yeah, so homelessness has been a big issue in Ada County and Boise and the region in recent years. And part of the debate has been over emergency shelters wish to move to State Street from their location in West Downtown called Interfaith Sanctuary. And the neighborhood in nearby to the new location, the Veterans Park Neighborhood Association, throughout this process has been against the shelter moving to where they are. It would mean upwards of 200 people who are experiencing homelessness staying at the shelter, and a lot of the neighbors have concerns about the effects that moving a congregate setting like that there would have on the neighborhood. And so last year, the Boise City Council imposed a number of conditions on the shelter, but allowed it to move its location. So they granted what's known as a conditional use permit, saying that the shelter could move. But since then, the Neighborhood Association filed a lawsuit asking a court to intervene because they said that the Boise City Council's decision had not considered the evidence correctly, had violated sort of the rules of how these conditional use permits are supposed to be granted. And so they wanted the judge to intervene and basically overturn the decision. And just this week, an Ada County district judge ruled against the Neighborhood Association and in favor of the Boise City Council and therefore Interfaith Sanctuary, arguing that the city council had properly considered the evidence, the pros and cons of moving the shelter, and the ways in which the effects the shelter might have on the neighborhood could be mitigated by the conditions that they've imposed. And so the Neighborhood Association, they can still appeal this decision, but for now they've lost the step in the court process.
So Ian, the shelter has not opened yet, though, or has it?
Right. It has not. They actually just a few weeks ago began construction of their new shelter on West State Street. This has been quite a prolonged process. It was a few years ago that they initially applied to build a shelter, and then because the approval process took a long time, there were appeals within the city government about this. Then once it was granted last year, then there was this lawsuit. So there have been sort of a lot of roadblocks along the way, but they've just beginning construction this summer. They plan to really get going in July. And at the moment, Interfaith Sanctuary says that they expect they'll complete construction next fall. So the fall of 2024 would be when this new location would open.
Oh, okay. So quite a while. Nate, tell us about this bizarre story of an East Idaho woman who's she's being federally prosecuted because she allegedly tried to hire a hitman on what ended up being a parody website.
Yeah, and this was actually reported nationally before anyone in Idaho got this, but it was interesting. This woman who's from Bear Lake County in Ovid, she went to a website called rentahitman.com. And if you go to this website, I think it's pretty clear to most people who would go that it's a joke website.
Yeah.
You can't really hire a hitman here. But despite that, she seemed to think it was the real thing because she submitted a form. She put in her address, her phone number, and who she wanted to be killed. And it was her ex-husband's new girlfriend. And she gave this whole long story about why she thought this woman needed to be killed. And the website owners were obviously a little surprised someone took this seriously. They turned it over to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives. And they opened an official investigation, and they actually had an agent reach out to her and pretend to be a hitman.
Wow.
And they gave her multiple chances to back out. I mean, they text messaged her over weeks, and she just she kept saying that she wanted to go through with it. Eventually, she ended up meeting with an agent, and she paid him $100, and she gave him a diamond ring that she said was valued at $1,500. And she said, if you want to make it look like a suicide, you can do that. Whatever's easiest for you. And she sent him on his way.
Wow.
And she got arrested.
Yeah. Okay. So now she's being federally prosecuted, right?
She is. She's on a U.S. Marshal's hold in the Jefferson County Jail. It's going to be in federal court. And that, I think it's grown a lot bigger than she thought it was going to.
Wow. It's really quite unbelievable. So I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. All right. Clark, we've talked about this on the program before. There is a movement going on to try and get an initiative on the ballot that would actually change how we vote here in Idaho. Now, the Attorney General's office came out with an opinion basically saying that you can't do this. And I know that's, summarizing it very, very, very much so. But what's going on now with this?
Yeah, the organizers of the Open Primary Initiative are moving forward despite this heavily critical review from Attorney General Raul Labrador's office. They're moving forward and they're requesting the ballot titles, which is the step that they're at right now. And that's one of the last steps they would take before starting their signature drive, hoping to qualify this for the 2024, November 2024 election. They mm-hmm. basically would have until May 1st to gather more than 64,000 signatures and then meet the threshold in the 18 of the 35 legislative districts. I talked to some of the people behind the Open Primary Initiative, and we can talk a little bit about what the initiative would do if it's successful. But they said that they expected a critical review from Attorney General Raul Labrador, because a few days after the initiative was announced, Raul Labrador had sent out a tweet responding to an earlier tweet about the initiative, and Attorney General Labrador said, we need to defeat these ideas coming from the left. And so they are saying that he injected his personal views on this. He was already coming out against it. And so basically they're at a disagreement over the legal questions. What the Attorney General's review had said is they're saying it does a couple of different things. They said it's not just one question, it's two that they would be putting forward, because it's dealing with changes to the primary election and to the general election. And then they're saying that it conflicts with a section of the Idaho Constitution that essentially says the person with the most votes wins, because this would change the general election. So we're waiting for these ballot titles, which again, Attorney General Labrador's office is going to have to issue. And those would be basically describing publicly what the initiative would do. Those would be attached to the petitions when they go out for signatures. If it makes it on the ballot, those would appear on the ballot on Election Day in 2024. And so basically, we're going to wait and see what these ballot titles look like. They're due at the end of the month, at the end of June. And there's also a provision in Idaho law that if the organizers of the Open Primary Initiative don't like it, they can go to the Idaho Supreme Court and request different ballot titles. So we had expected kind of from the beginning that this would be a big legal fight and a big legal struggle, because the initiative kind of goes against rules that the Idaho Republican Party and the Idaho legislature had really pushed for about mm-hmm. 12 years ago. And so we knew that it was going to be a big fight and a long, drawn out process, and that continues. But we should have more information at the very end of this month about whether the ballot titles are going to be accepted and then they'll move forward with the signatures, or whether this is going to go back into court. But what the initiative, if it's successful, what it would be all about would be eliminating the closed primary system that we have in the state of Idaho, which basically means that if you're not affiliated and officially registered with a political party, you can't vote in their primary election. In Idaho, we do have an exception. The Idaho Democratic Party has made their primary open to all voters, but all the other ones are closed. And if this is successful, this would also make it so that the top four vote getters from the primary, regardless of what political party they're from, would all go forward to the general election. And then we'd have something called ranked choice voting, where you would mm-hmm. if this passes, you would vote for your favorite, for the candidate you would want to win, but you would also mark the others in order of preference, like 2, 3, and 4. And it would create this instant runoff process. So if one of the candidates didn't get 50% or more on the first round, the last place finisher would be eliminated. That candidate's next votes would go to the other people on the ballot, starting with the number two preference. So it would totally change our elections. And what the organizers are saying is that with this closed primary system, we only have less than 10% of people voting on these decisions in the primaries. We all know Idaho is a supermajority state. And so in a lot of legislative districts, a lot of races across the state, the Republican primary is really the closest contested election. And so it's a little bit complicated. I know there's some legal disagreements and we sort of expected that. But by the end of this month or looking into 4th of July, we should have more answers about whether they're going to start collecting signatures in public or whether this is going to go to the courts first. And so I know that a bunch of us will continue to cover it and be happy to walk through the developments, because this would be a big change that voters would be asked to be considered. And we want to let people know what's going on and what the issues are. So I know that a bunch of us will continue to follow that for you.
Right. And we'll have you on to talk more in depth about it, because it is such a it's so layered that even just, I think, an overview on the roundtable probably doesn't do it enough justice. So we will, of course, make sure, Clark, that we have you back on to really talk more in depth about this at a later date. With that said, Nicole, Mormon crickets are swarming parts of Idaho right now. I mean, I realize that this happens. However, not every summer is as bad as it seems to be this summer.
Yeah, Gemma. So it's interesting. Mormon crickets, I think people are used to hearing about them pretty much every summer. They get particularly bad down in the Owyhees, so southwest of us. And they are right in the middle of kind of a cyclical reproduction cycle where they reach a peak, and we are at that peak right now. And there can just be tens of thousands of them, and they have a tendency as a species to band together in these huge groups and march across, you know, they'll be across roads, they'll kind of mow down crops, and they can actually become a hazard when they're on roads, because once people start running over them with cars, the roadway can get really slippery. Idaho Transportation Department has to go out and clear off those roads. And the State Department of Agriculture tries to put down some bait on the sides of roads to prevent it from getting that bad to begin with. But they definitely advise people to take caution if they're down in the Owyhees and happen to notice a lot of these bugs around.
Wow. Okay. Ian, get us updated on this this mine, this cobalt mine near Salmon. It stopped production, but you're reporting that the military now has some potential interest in this?
Yeah. So cobalt in recent years has gotten a lot of attention because of its application and use in electric vehicle batteries, which, as we know, are increasing production, increasing sales, and in the coming years. But cobalt also has applications for military uses. It can be used in some munitions and other large scale batteries that the military uses, as well as aerospace uses. And so this mine near Salmon that hasn't opened yet, but it's owned by an Australian mining company called Jervois. They've now secured $15 million in funding from the Department of Defense, which I think sort of emphasizes the significance of this mine, which would be, if it opens, the only primary cobalt mine in the United States. And they're going to use this funding, the company is, to further explore the resource they have up there to see really how much cobalt is underground near the potential mine site. And they're also going to explore the potential of opening a cobalt refinery, because that's another big dynamic here, is that when you have mining, of course, you then also need to process the raw material into something that's usable in a battery or whatever other use you're going to have. And another reason the military is interested in that is because China controls the vast majority of both production and refining of cobalt on a world scale. And as cobalt potentially becomes more important as more of the U.S. economy transitions to green energy, it's important to the U.S. government that we secure a domestic supply of these resources, or at least a supply that's sort of more secured through allied countries. And so the U.S. is both interested in cobalt mining and also in potentially opening refineries on U.S. soil.
And so when will we potentially know more about this?
So the mine is still not slated to open at a specific time. The reason that they stopped, they were very close to getting up to production earlier this year, and then they abruptly stopped in March. And that was because the price of cobalt had tumbled. And I'll note also that there is some uncertainty about cobalt's use, because at least in electric vehicles, there are various battery chemistry technologies that are competing for dominance in the electric vehicle battery space, because cobalt and some other critical minerals are very expensive to procure. And so requiring them to be used in batteries might be keeping the price up of, passenger vehicles that people might purchase. And so car automakers are always looking for ways to reduce their costs. And so there are some battery systems now that might not use cobalt. And so, but there are a lot that still do. So there's some uncertainty about how much cobalt we're going to need.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
From an Iraq war cover-up to towns ravaged by opioids to the roots of our modern immigration crisis, Embedded explores what's been sealed off and undisclosed. NPR's original investigative podcast reveals why these stories and the people behind them matter. Listen to the Embedded podcast, only from NPR.